Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Book Spider podcast. This is a book of the week format podcast where we capture our chosen book in our web and do our best to suck the juices of meaning out of it with the most insightful and most thoughtful, most cerebral analysis that we are able to achieve. We try to position the book's themes and techniques within the larger web of text that we've built in the course of our journey. At the Book Spider podcast, we strive to be a serious literature podcast for the discriminating listener. We pledge to do nothing to make the podcast or ourselves seem any more down-to-earth or approachable than it really is. I am Hans Berger. I'm going to be heading this week's episode with my standard co-hosts, Chris Malmberg and Patrick Barney. And this week we are going to be covering Split Tooth by Tanya Tagaq. Just a heads up to everybody that the synopsis I'm about to do does contain quite a lot of spoilers. If you haven't read this novel, it is very good. I think all three of us would recommend it pretty highly. The audiobook is really fantastic if you have any interest in that version. So, you know, if you haven't read it and you think there's any possibility at all that you might, then, you know, go check it out. Go check the book out. So Split Tooth is a novel primarily. There are a few aspects of mixed genre, mixed media to it that we're going to talk about in a bit more length. But it's in terms of kind of the bulk of content, it is primarily a novel. And it was Tagaq's first novel, although she has quite a long and distinguished reputation as a singer. Which we're not going to go too much into depth about here, just because it's off the topic of a little off the topic of the podcast. But she is a very well regarded singer with a very impressive body of work. So, Split Tooth begins as a relatively straightforward novel about growing up in a rural Canadian village in the 1970s as a Nunavut, an Indigenous person in that area. And it has an episodic quality to the early sections, right, where we see a series of episodes from the life of the unnamed protagonist, who is a teenage girl. And, you know, her life in that village in the 70s, in some ways is very bleak, can be very dark. It includes substance abuse, sexual abuse, bullying. But it also has these really great moments of joy and transcendence as well. And those are generally told in a fairly straightforward fashion, which really has a kind of vivid, almost documentarian quality to it. But those very grounded snapshots of moments of life growing up in that village are interspersed with periodic diversions into what you might call a more mythical or mystical register. Most notably, early on, she has an encounter with a fox spirit who she frees from a family curse via a blowjob. And then about halfway through the novel, there's a fusion of these two modes, right, where a fusion of that kind of straightforward documentarian mode and the mythical mode, right? When she has a sexual experience with the Northern Lights, she becomes pregnant. She has twins, a boy named Savik and a girl named Nadja. And both of the twins have mystical powers. Savik is what you might loosely call an energy vampire, and he kills her favorite uncle and begins feeding off her father and feeding off a boy she's close to. And she recognizes that she needs to kill Savik. During her attempt to do so, Nadja dies, but then the two twins, their bodies fuse into a seal, and the seal swims away under sea ice. So the first thing that I wanted to do was just give both of you guys an opportunity to start by talking a little bit about your general thoughts and responses to this. I'm going to assume this was probably a first-time read for both of you. I read it not too long after it came out. This is a second read for me. I reread it fairly recently for this podcast. So, Chris, Patrick, what were your guys' initial impressions and responses going through this book?
I was definitely struck by it. I kind of feel like I was more struck by it than kind of emotionally and in sort of the experience of it than intellectually. I fear that the episodic kind of fragmented narrative where like different, as you kind of talked about it, very straight telling of things of a series of events intertwined with, you know, more mythical register and, you know, her, the story going into a kind of a space that, seems pretty explicitly magical realism, but also like, and this is maybe like my very Western, you know, sort of like the possibility of understanding it from like my perspective, are mythical things happening, or is this like a psychological sort of response to trauma and abuse? A lens through which to sort of like understand or process that. I was really, really struck by it, but the fragmentation and complexity of it, I feel like a second read would definitely be very valuable. But I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Excellent. Patrick?
I thought it was great. I agree with Chris that, like, I think on a second read through, I would glean more and like have a deeper understanding of an even deeper understanding of what's going on and what it all amounts to. But just on a first read, a fantastic experience. Like, you know, super, super interesting structures. Like fragmentary stuff, which I kind of like a lot, actually, like when it's done right. Like another book that comes to mind that mixes media is, oh, and now I'm drawing a blank on the name of it, but it's a work that mixes short stories, poetry, and plays, and is about black experience in various eras of United States history. I totally forget the name of it and the author, but anyway, yeah, super, super great. Really enjoyed it. My main question is, what does all the throat singing have to do with, like, what are these what are these weird sounds that, you know, I listened to the novel and the author Tanya Tagak read the novel that I listened to, so she's like doing all these weird sounds like you know, way better than I could do it, but and I'm just like, what does this mean, what is this all about, like, is this the sounds of you blowing that fox spirit? Is that what this is about? I don't know. Super interesting.
Yeah. Well, we'll definitely talk about the mixed media quality to it, right? That's one of the things that I wanted to talk about. I think the really key thing, though, maybe the thing that we kind of have to lead off with, because it is so core, I think, to all of our experiences of the book, is the blending of a... the blending of a kind of realist documentarian novel with what we call the kind of a magical realism register, right? And you know, both of you guys mentioned that it might you might feel like you understood it better on a second reading. This was a second reading for me, and in some ways, I maybe felt like I understood it less, actually, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason I think maybe that I understood it less was I had more of a sense of maybe being that I had more of a sense on a second read that maybe the kind of set of habitual tools that I have to understand reality in a novel don't completely make sense with this work, right? And obviously, you know, we're all coming from a very kind of very classically Western background, right? We're all Western rationalist agnostics, roughly speaking. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, right, there's a set of categories that we have for processing things which are not strictly realist fiction, right? So a couple of the responses that we mentioned were, well, this is magical realism, right? Which is, you know, as I understand the term, fiction in which you have everyday life in a fairly realist way, except there are aspects of magic woven into that as it would be if those existed in the real world, right? And I suppose that's a reasonable way to describe this, but it feels limiting at the same time too, right? It feels like there's a set of assumptions built into that category that are not actually built into the writing of the work, if that makes sense. And you mentioned, Chris, yeah, the idea of this being perhaps something that you would process as a hallucination, or that the experience is maybe like a subjective experience that's coming about as a response to trauma, right?
Yes.
And I think like that's a reasonable interpretation. And at the same time, it's also once again an interpretation that is just kind of like coming from a set of assumptions that the text is not, right?
Totally agree.
Just to like kind of emphasize the like what we're talking about, I wanted to add an anecdote. I remember teaching like an English 101 class a few years ago, and Cincinnati State has a lot of international students, a lot of students from Africa, the Middle East, and other places. And I had one student in class who, he was from a not sub-Saharan, above Saharan Africa. So, you know, and he literally believed in spirits that inhabited, you know, parts of the desert. And, you know, I didn't really like pursue the discussion in the class, but, you know, he was trying to insist to me that these spirits were real and they existed. And I wonder if similarly we do a disservice by calling this magical realism if this worldview includes magical things like spirits. You know, to like magical realism is, you know, it's a technique, it's a style, hope with various purposes, right? But if, well, I suppose, you know, now that I think about it, like, you know, mentioning like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you know, the noted magical realist, maybe the point of magical realism is to try to point out that like something about a spiritual type of life is real. So I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think that like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, I think Garcia Marquez or Salman Rushdie or Isabel Allende, I think all those authors, I don't think any of those authors, I think they all on some level, and I'm not, you know, maybe somebody can dig up an interview that proves me wrong in this. I am making assumptions here that I'm not 100% qualified to back up if I were, you know, on a congressional panel or something. But I would assume that Gabriel Garcia Marquez fundamentally thinks that like the types of magical things that occur in his novels do not exist in the real world, right? It does not rain uninterruptedly for 100 years in the real world.
Right.
And he processes those as fundamentally narrative devices that involve invention, right?
Right.
He is consciously taking, I mean, I think that I would assume that Garcia Marquez or Salman Rushdie, fundamentally, their understandings of objective reality probably are not at all that different from mine. And they are deliberately, consciously using things that they and I would both understand as storytelling inventions as a technique. And so I don't think that that is... I don't think that that's quite what's happening here, right? But at the same time, right. You know, I tried to do a little bit of research about things that Tagak has said about the uses of what we might call like what we're calling kind of fantasy or spirit or spiritualism, and I wasn't able to find a lot about it. There's something about the idea of just doing an interview, right, where you asked her point blank, like, hey, do you believe in all this stuff? Literally? Like, that would also be incredibly crass, right?
Right.
And I guess the point that I'm trying to make is there's kind of just a... Because I am so fundamentally rooted in a rationalist Western perspective... there's just a way in which I don't know that I can ever totally... any of the understandings I would bring to bear on how this is meant to function or what relationship it's supposed to have to the objective world, all those are in some way going to be inadequate or reductionist, right? I mean, the version that the inadequate reductionist lens that I had was allegory, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Northern Lights is an allegory for something when she has sex with it. And the twins are an allegory for something. Are the twins an allegory for native culture? Are the twins an allegory? Is you know, her, the twin, Savik, is he an allegory for alcoholism, perhaps? Is he an allegory for the kind of decadent spirit that burns the candle at both ends and the way that it both brings joy and saps strength? I don't think that's true, right? But it was very hard for me to not approach it in that way, right? It was very hard for me not to approach it as some kind of essentially like a coded message that had to sort of be cracked, right? Which again is... to some extent maybe helpful in fashioning one's own understanding of the work, but is ultimately probably inadequate, right? It's odd because I don't want to think that, I mean, this should be accessible, I think, to somebody who does not have a deep grounding in the cultural traditions that it comes from, right? So I also don't want to say that like I cannot get this book because I'm too much of a Western rationalist. I don't know. I'm having a little bit of trouble finding a way to pitch what I'm trying to say. What were you going to say, Chris? Sorry to cut you off.
No, I was the one cutting you off. But it just is kind of, it's something that actually occurred to me briefly while reading it and enough to kind of look up and kind of remind myself about it. But I think, Hans, you were in the same course as I was when we read Irigaray, right? About feminist language versus basically gendered language. And
I think I was, yeah, but it's all slipped out of my head now.
Well, it's kind of what you're describing is something that occurred to me when I was trying to, and I wanted to, like, I said I agreed. I really feel like I'm committing a kind of a reductionist crime on the novel when I, you know, suggest that this is all sort of in the protagonist's head, in in sort of wrestling with the, or processing the traumas that she's experiencing or it has experienced, too. And, but I feel inclined to try to reduce it to some meaning. Like, is the seal at the end that the twins become, symbolic of something? It's heavily, we should talk about, you know, maybe if we have time, the kind of Christian themes at the very end where she is in hell, saving souls, which feels like it's attempting, or it, you know, in my single read through, attempting to bridge these, more, indigenous mythical elements to a kind of Christian mythos, right? There's something at the end there that is really fascinating. Like I was really blown away by that, and what it seemed to be doing that I don't understand, but and I hope this doesn't complicate it too much. I think that a big aspect of this novel is that it is very, it feels like it's living in a feminine mode. It's expressing itself in a feminine mode, and going back to Irigaray and my poor memory of it, it seemed as though and I don't know that the author was thinking of Irigaray, but that there is this tradition of thinking about male versus female gendered language, the male language forcing things to mean something, forcing things to a linear understanding, and the female language being multiple and exploding out from that prison. And, you know, I might be committing a kind of an academic, you know, maybe I'm reacting like sort of habitually academically to this in sort of like reaching for some sort of, you know, theoretical lens, but that did occur to me. And maybe Irigaray is a little bit of a red herring, but I think an aspect of the mythical here does feel feminine to me. And there is a kind of a, not just Western, but I feel also a kind of a male urge to make sense of stuff that I don't necessarily understand. That I wonder if we had, you know, diversity is important, a woman on this podcast with us, there might be an aspect of understanding that isn't purely rooted in the symbolic, but also like lived female experience.
I can't comment on the feminine aspect that you're kind of seeing in here. Not that I think you're wrong or anything. But I brought up my student earlier because I wanted to point out that I think that in some sense these things are real, what's happening. Like, I did not, like, I see exactly why we would think, you know, well, these happenings are, you know, hallucinations or the results of trauma or, you know, post-traumatic stress or whatever. But I really think that the novel wants to indicate that somehow these things are real. Maybe not literally real, as in, like, our main character is not literally performing fellatio on a fox, you know, who is cursed or whatnot. But somehow these things are real. I don't know how, and that's probably because I'm wrapped up in a Western mindset. But I think that I want to say that magic realism is not the right lens to view this from. And I think that, you know, thinking about these things as if they are real in some way is probably better. I don't, you know, I'm not sure you know, at least to, you know, when we talk about my student or we talk about people who are Christian, you know, God is literally real, right? You know, he is literally a force or a spirit or something that can hear you and watches over you and that loves you. So I think, you know, it might offend a Christian if a Christian writes a, you know, writes a novel and we say, well, this is magical realism. If, I mean, that's if you're right, Hans, that like Marquez is absolutely using the techniques of magical realism all the while knowing that these things are not part of objective reality or believing that they're not part of objective reality. So I don't know what my alternative is, but I'm going to answer your question, Hans, and say, no, we shouldn't think of this as magical realist.
Well, and it may be that the structure of our podcast and the nature of our relationship to literature is causing us to overcomplicate a very simple question, right? What is this? This is a story in which there is a character, a set of things happen to her, she has a set of experiences, she processes them in a particular emotional way as a well-rounded character will, and that's that, right? And
sure.
There doesn't necessarily have to be any greater answer beyond that, right? Except
what?
That there does, because that's how we operate, you know?
Right.
And
I don't
think it's harmful to operate that way, right?
Well, me
as
neither.
Long as you're doing so in a conscious way, you know. We have a certain set of we keep around a hammer and a saw and a screwdriver, and normally we either get a screw or a piece of wood that needs sawed or a nail, right? And we happen here to have encountered something which is not a screw or a nail or a 2x4, and we don't have the right tools. But in some way, there isn't necessarily, maybe there's nothing that needs to be done to it beyond saying, you know, this is a story about a character who lives in a difficult situation, has an encounter with the spirit world, which exists within the universe of the story being told in the novel, and leaves that experience feeling a greater sense of power and agency, right?
Right. Yeah, I absolutely like that. I like how you've put that. Like, we don't necessarily have the tools to approach this thing properly, but it's okay because this is a, you know, this is an effective story in a number of ways, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, in some sense, we do have the tools to approach it appropriately, which is to say, okay, well, this is, I mean, saying like narratively, this is a well-developed protagonist who has an experience which she grows from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is a kind of a classic tool of analysis, right?
Right.
It's something maybe more that I associate with like screenwriting, right? Like, but it is an analytical perspective.
Sure.
So there's an episode, the next thing I want to talk about, I do want to get to the mixed media question, but there's another thing that I think, I don't know for sure if this will bear fruit, but I'm really curious what you guys thought. There's an episode that opens the novel in which the narrator and several other children are in a closet, right? And they're hiding from a loud drunken party downstairs, and they can tell from what's coming through the closet door that the party is to some extent fun and to some extent violent and scary, right? And an uncle of one of the children opens the door, and he's got blood running down his face. He opens the door of the closet where he's hiding, and he says, "I just wanted to tell you kids, not to be scared. And that read to me as funny in a very dark way, right? But there's kind of like a dry, pitch black humor to that encounter. And that set some expectation for me that the tone of the book would then lean toward dark or dry humor in a way that I'm not sure it does. But it might. I don't know. So my question was, how much of a role did humor serve in your encounter with the text? And if it was there, what purpose is it serving?
I think, Patrick, you'll have to weigh in too. Your experience of that as humor, Hans, might be because you didn't have Tanya Takac reading it to you. It's not as funny.
Right.
It's sort of haunting and terrifying when she reads it. She's a very effective, by the way, reader. She's really good.
She was great.
She was awesome.
She was awesome.
And it is not dry funny when we get to the blood-covered uncle saying that. It is a little bit, I guess, like discordant, right? There's almost the way that it read for me was horrifying but weirdly sweet, like a weird kind of sweetness, but and maybe a little bit funny. The humor in the novel, it's the thing that my head jumps to, you know, is when she pushes the sexual predator at her school down the stairs at the party. And the humor seemed to me to be cutting into a real pervasive darkness, a real suffocating, depressing kind of ambient toxic energy that ran through.
That's awesome. That's a good description, ambient toxic energy.
Yeah, and the alcoholism, the sexual abuse, her own relationship to girlhood and becoming a woman. Also had, I think, like elements, you know, her attitude toward her breasts or the ways in which she was competing with other girls for attention.
Golf balls.
Yeah, golf balls. There was humor there that seemed to kind of really blend nicely with this. It just was enough to balance out just how uncomfortable the novel was. Patrick, what was your experience of that?
Didn't read humorous. Not much of the novel read humorous to me. I did think the golf balls was funny and maybe a few other quips here or there, but overall, my experience was like, like this ratcheting back and forth between somberness and like frenetic passion and energy.
Fury.
Yeah. Definitely.
So, one thing that I think has come up a few times in the conversation up until now is the mixture of form and media, right? The bulk of the text is likely best understood as a novel, but there are occasional poems interspersed. And interestingly enough, like we've mentioned, I own a paperback copy of the novel. Chris and Patrick both encountered it as an audiobook. There are illustrations in the paperback. There are moments of throat singing in the novel. Sorry, in the audiobook version. Just to clarify, was the throat singing like would she stop the narration and sing, or was it mixed in as a background element under the narration?
She would stop and sing.
Okay, so the songs were actually interspersed with the text.
Right. But it was there were probably at least 30.
Yeah, there were a bunch of them.
Yeah.
Like every.
And was the. There are also, in my version, there are things that are spaced as poems, right? And they have titles like poems. Like they're basically just poems interspersed with the chapters. Well, they don't all have titles, but there are things that are spaced as poems and laid out as poems interspersed with chapters of narration. Did you guys have anything that registered as poetic?
The voice would change. I mean, she didn't, I think the throat singing was serving as a break basically between sections.
Right.
And
yeah,
occasionally
I don't recall any poems.
I definitely became conscious of the fact that some of the sections were pretty short and the voice would be different. Especially in the beginning, I think, Hans, wasn't something I was conscious of listening to it, but you said reading it, it was probably much more obvious to you, not so obvious to Patrick and I probably, that it was tick-tocking between that documentarian, you know, sort of like, this is what it was like to be a little girl in this village, you know, in the 70s, and a more mythic poetic mode. So some of those kind of bled together, but it kind of became something of a pattern that I was aware of, where Tanya Takak would read a narrative and then throat sing for 20 seconds, and then the voice would be different from the section that came before, and it would be a little bit shorter. So I assume that was the poetry, but I don't remember any titles. Patrick, do you remember any titles?
No, I don't.
Yeah, and when I was flipping through, I think there's just one poem that has a title. That just happens to be the thing that I flipped to first when I went through. Yeah, I think there's just one or maybe one or two others that... there's one called That Time. There's one called Misplaced.
Read one.
And
let me see if I recall.
If it rings a bell.
Yeah.
Okay. Misplaced. My womb is impregnated with mourning. The past and I are conceiving, heaving, birthing sorrow, intangible currency. Misplaced kitchen knives. My sliced honor carries a flag covered with bright colors. Steep cliffs want me to pretend to have feathers. Hang your black hair over me, not under. March your black boots over me, not under. Blinking sawdust, loud dry labor. I smell falsehood. I open my palms to reveal an alley of sled dogs eating lies. I press my mouth to the ground and join them.
There were a couple section two, if I remember, sections of the audiobook where she sings with music, so not just the throat mm-hmm. singing, but she sings actual lyrics. Maybe that's one of the songs she sang.
It could
does
be.
That, does that seem right, Chris?
I think that might be one of them.
Okay.
And it might be, I mean, the poems, it might be that they... The things that I registered as poems because of spacing, there are quite a few. I mean, you said there are about 30 throat singing intervals. There's probably about 30 poems or more. They're probably by page, maybe a quarter of the text, give or take. But the things that they might have just seemed like a more impressionistic part of the narration to you guys. I don't know.
I think that
yeah, maybe.
I think that's the case. I mean, just glancing at the chapter lengths, it does look like not a perfectly alternating structure, but like something, a section that's 10 minutes long, followed by something that's 30 seconds to to a minute and a half long, followed by a longer section, followed by a shorter section. So I think that that's, but listening to it, you know, it's not calling attention to itself as, and I actually kind of liked that seamlessness in listening to it. But I think that it probably meant that I was less conscious of what was happening.
That might have been okay, though, actually, that you were, I mean, I didn't really connect with the poems the way that I did with the narrated sections, frankly. And a lot of that probably just had to do with my own habits as a reader. I don't, frankly, read a lot of poetry. I read a great deal of fiction. I almost never just sit down and read a poem to read a poem, right? And I think of those habitually, as being very different kind of modes of approach as a reader, which, I mean, I do think, like, if a poet were here, they would want me to think that way, right? You don't read a poem the way that you read a short story. Again, at least in the kind of tradition and viewpoint that we come from, right? The three of us do.
Right.
And I found having to make that shift jarring, and having to make that shift repeatedly, I found a bit jarring. And I don't know that. So my habit with the poems was to approach the poems kind of almost as like arias in an opera, right? It, like, structurally, what, you know, in an opera, you've got your recitative and you've got your aria, right? And the recitative is in more of a kind of spoke-sung version, in more of a spoke-sung framework, and it advances action. And then the aria allows you to kind of live within a dramatic point for a bit. Also kind of like, you know, songs in a musical, right? And I was kind of approaching the poems as songs in a musical and thinking of them in that kind of, with that kind of, putting that particular structural kind of, you know, boundary around them. The shift in reading approach was difficult for me, and I didn't actually end up feeling like I had a level of understanding of kind of, I didn't feel like I had a level of dramatic understanding of the character that I wouldn't have had just reading the prose sections. But it sounds like for you guys kind of just approaching it all as a unified text, not having those assumptions brought to bear about what different media should do or how to engage with those, it sounds like it was a much more seamless and effective experience for you.
I would say yes to that assumption, at least for me.
Yeah.
Interesting. So kind of my pre-existing ideas about prose fiction versus poetry were ultimately probably detrimental to appreciating the work.
It might honestly also have to do with Tanya Tikhak. I actually highly recommend Hans listening to this audiobook. It's really short. It's, you know, the novel's short, but, like, she's an excellent reader. She's obviously, and I haven't listened to her, I looked her up, apparently she's a big deal. But she is a real presence. And the throat singing, the way in which I'm not consciously delineating one section from another, maybe in the same way when you're thinking about them spatially organized on, you know, on a page, made it feel a little more blended together than it sounds like it was for you. Like it was a kind of continuous experience.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I'll probably try to do that. I might give it a little bit of time in between, you know, this reading, just to let all the impressions settle and get a little bit of distance from the thoughts that I had about it right now. But yeah, if I can, I would like the idea of coming back to this and approaching the audiobook maybe in a year or two.
Sure. Yeah.
So this then begins, I think, the part of the podcast where we often will talk about this work in relationship to most commonly other things that we have read and discussed for the podcast, occasionally maybe just things that we happen to have encountered outside the podcast. This may be less accessible to people that don't have our whole kind of personal history as readers under their own belts. But alternately, you know, if you read Split Tooth and you really enjoyed it, this might signal other things that you could approach that would be interesting. And if you do read those things, of course, there are episodes about that as well, right? So when I chose this work, I did so in response to our last episode's novel, which was Martin Dressler. And I said, maybe somewhat obliquely or flippantly when I was making that choice, that in some ways this was kind of a mirror image of Martin Dressler, right? Now, what I meant at the time was just that, you know, Martin Dressler is, it's a novel partly about the immigrant experience and partly about the inevitability of technological progress and about kind of the whether it's critical or not was a point of discussion, right? But it's about progress in kind of a larger, more general sense and about the kind of the habit of capitalism, of the kind of constant churn of capitalism and culture, right? The constant churn of capitalism and materially based Western culture. And this, of course, is a novel about an indigenous experience and about a way of life that is generally very removed from that kind of constant churn and from the sort of the Western idea of linear history and progress. And so, you know, if those of you who listened to our Martin Dressler episode last time, if you're wondering what I meant when I said that this was a mirror image, that's really what I meant, right? That Dressler is about the restless urge toward progress. This is about the reclamation of tradition. And, you know, obviously a lot of books could stand in for either Dressler or Split Tooth in making that dichotomy, right? But did you guys have any thoughts about the relationship between these two that you wanted to offer?
I was going to ask you.
I don't know if I do, actually. I felt like I should address Dressler because I made that connection in the last episode. But having brought that up, I think actually like the worlds they're describing are so different and the approaches they're taking are so different that I don't know if there's a lot of interpretive fruit to be, you know, plucked there.
Yeah, they seemed significantly different to me, like in terms of almost everything. Like stylistically, Dressler is straightforward realism. This is, even if in some sense, you know, like the worldview represents reality, the worldview of the novel Split Tooth represents reality, it still doesn't strike me as realist in the same way. You know, Dressler is ambiguous, and this novel doesn't, I mean, I don't know. I don't actually think this novel is that ambiguous as far as, like, you know, what are we supposed to feel? What are we supposed to get out of Split Tooth? Seems to be, you know, something that you've said before, Hans, like a young woman experiences trauma in her, you know, early years and, you know, begins to process it and grow stronger. Whereas Dressler, I wasn't sure what the arc was at all, really. Like, you know, as I mentioned last time, like I want all novels to be 1984, like totally cut and dried.
Well, if nothing else, then maybe there was some interest in, you know, ticking down all the ways this is completely unlike the book I compared it to.
Right.
The book that it did make me think about a lot, though, a lot more, that we've been through recently, much more because of structure than because really of theme, I think. But a few episodes ago, I think my last pick for the podcast, if I remember right, was No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood. No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood. And in some ways, almost it almost is... There's almost kind of an uncanny quality to kind of the narrative structural similarity of the two, even though in many ways they're very, very, very different, right? And what I mean by that is that both novels have the first half of both novels is very fragmentary and is kind of a series of images, a series of somewhat disconnected vignettes and images that you kind of... don't seem to have any kind of internal arc, but which do portray in a fairly kind of documentary way the kind of day-to-day texture of the life of the protagonist. And then in both novels, there's a pregnancy and birth which occur right around the midway part that pull everything together into a much more kind of defined... that pull what had previously been something fragmentary into a defined narrative. In both cases, the child is different in some way, right? Different from the normal run of human experience. And in both cases, the narrative ends shortly after the death of the child, with the protagonist having grown in some way, which is... a bit ambiguous, right? And I don't know that I have much to say about... I don't know if I have a great way to frame the question of what the meaning is of that structural parallel, but it struck me, and it definitely seemed worth commenting on, right? I don't know. Did you guys have any thoughts about how kind of plot and structure... function similarly in both works?
Well, when I saw your question, this isn't plot and structure so much as theme. Maybe plot, the protagonist in Split Tooth is sort of, you mentioned mirrors before with Martin Dressler, sort of mirror to the protagonist in No One Is Talking About This, and in that the protagonist in No One Is Talking About This is basically invested in a turbulent surface level world that has no depth of meaning beyond constantly mixing or remixing and recycling images and, you know, memes and different hot takes in a representation of how the internet has shaped, you know, how we engage with information now, and it not having any depth is part of that, the, you know, her arc. And in Split Tooth, there is something else that, you know, this is in the 70s, something else that is sort of between the protagonist and a grounding in her culture. But, like, you know, it's not the internet. I don't know if it's, you know, this is post-colonialist take or not, but you know, exactly why her village life is this way. You know, does it have to do with, you know, what has changed around her people, you know, with, you know, the modern age? But it seems as though Split Tooth is more, she's seeking much more explicitly this relationship with, you know, this grounded, a groundedness, a meaningfulness in her life. I don't know if that, I said mirror, but I was going to say that the protagonist in Splittooth starts out with a better relationship, a stronger relationship to meaning and meaningful living than the protagonist in, no one is talking about this, but then I wondered if that was true given the alcoholism, the abuse and everything like that. I don't know. I wanted to say that they both seem to be also invested in this search for meaning, not just, and that is setting the table for the appearance of children, for babies to enter the scene. And, I don't know if that helps or is useful.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the protagonist in the first half of Splittooth, I don't think that she lives in an absence of meaning precisely, but she does process the world in a very intuitive, unanalytical kind of way, right? Which I guess makes sense because she's a child, right? I mean, that's generally the way that children behave and think. And, you know, the protagonist of No One Is Talking About This, interestingly, both are unnamed protagonists also, now mm-hmm. that I think about it. Mm-hmm. The protagonist in No One Is Talking About This processes the world in a, I mean, she has a lot of difficulty with analysis because of fragmentation, right? But I don't know, it's hard because in both those texts we see so little of time after the primary experience of the text, right? The childbirth and then death. In both cases, we see little enough of what comes after the transformative event that it can be a little challenging to diagnose what is wrong before the transformative event, right? I mean, I guess the easy analogy would be to say, you know, in the case of No One Is Talking About This, it's the internet. In the case of Splittooth, it's alienation from tradition and alcoholism. But, I mean, I do think that there is a... The protagonist in Splittooth, there's a kind of... The experiences she has interacting with the natural world do have kind of an intuitive clarity to them that suggests a level of groundedness that I don't think there's an easy analogy for with No One Is Talking About This. All right. Well, that gets us, I think that gets us through all the questions that I had, and that gets us to probably a pretty good stopping point. I don't know that we've necessarily, I think we've spent a lot more time kind of thinking about the ways that we don't fully understand this text, or the ways in which our habit of coming to the ways in which our senses of what would constitute understanding are maybe not as helpful here as they would be for, you know, I don't know, The Fall by Camus, which is another prior text that we spent a lot of time kind of fighting with, right? But it's definitely been illuminating to talk about it, and I certainly appreciate your guys' attention to it and your spending some time to chat with me about it. Did you guys My have pleasure. any last thoughts or observations about Splittooth before Patrick tells us the next thing we're going to read?
I really enjoyed it. Thought it was a great pick.
Yeah, loved it.
Good, good, good. I did too. All right, so Patrick, what will be the focus of our next episode?
So I with Splittooth, I was really interested in the the motif of animals, and which, you know, like to many indigenous cultures, animals are very important. I remember reading a pretty fantastic work of nonfiction for my comprehensive exam in Alaska that categorized many of the symbolic, much of the symbolic importance of animals in Athabascan tribes, in Athabascan cultures, excuse me. Tribes is not the right word. So I found that very interesting. So I thought it might be fun to do a work that features an animal protagonist and to connect it to this novel and see, like, what are the different ways in which animals, like, how are animals being used and for what purpose? And, you know, what are we thinking about animals? So I thought that would be cool. But then I recently read, so I had one novel in mind, and that's Timbuktu by Paul Auster. But then just this past week, I picked up another book called Sirius, spelled like the star, by Olaf Stapledon. D-O-N. And both the novels are short. Both the novels feature a dog protagonist. So I thought it would be cool if we could read both and compare their uses of animal protagonists. And, sure, you know, also compare their use of animals to Split Tooth. Now, Paul Auster we've read before, and he's what you would call more of a literary writer. And so Timbuktu is more of a literary work. And then we've got Sirius by Olaf Stapledon, and that's more of what we would call a genre work, I suppose. But, I think at the very worst, it is probably in line with something like by another work we discussed, Sphere by Michael Crichton, where maybe it's a genre work, but at the very worst, it's thought-provoking and interesting, even if it's not, like, mind-blowing stylistically. And together, I would say those two novels probably amount to one 400-page novel, so I figured it would be, you know, not too bad to do both.
All right, so that concludes this episode of Book Spider on the novel Split Tooth by Tanya Tagok. All three of us really enjoyed this and certainly would recommend it if the discussion was interesting to you and you somehow haven't read it already. Next episode, we'll be talking about Sirius by Olaf Stapledon and Timbuktu by Paul Auster. So check back in for those in a couple weeks.